Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1329. Conversations with Monty number 3. This is being recorded on June 8th of the year 2024. Very quickly, before we get into the meat of the program, I'm joined by my new co-host, Monty. Links at the top of each written For the Record description and at the top of each Food for Thought post. One of them will enable you to subscribe to the podcast that sister station at WFMU is producing. And another will enable you to obtain the 32 gigabyte flash drive of all of my life's work, almost a half century of programming, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books. By the way, one of which is going to figure front and center in the discussion today. So once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to present my new co-host, Monty. And this, in one sense, could be deemed, For the Record 2.0, the Monty and Emery Show. It is not only with great pleasure that I introduce Monty, but with a degree of satisfaction. When Monty is unpacking his research for me, for us, I consider myself to be a student of his work. So, with that introduction, Monty, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
It's a genuine privilege to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Alrighty. Now, I'm going to give a brief synopsis of what we spoke about in our last two shows, For the Record 1327 and 1328. And feel free, Monty, to add anything that you think needs to be included. And then I'm going to give a description. I'm going to read right from the description for the book Falanque by Alan Chase from 1943. Because it's front and center to what we're talking about today. We began the show last week with my reading of the transcript of a meeting between Prince Max Eugen von Hohenlohe and Alan Dulles in early 1943. Prince Max Eugen von Hohenlohe was a member of the Habsburg family by marriage. And in Spain, which is front and center, he in turn was operating as an emissary for Walter Schoenberg, who was in charge of foreign intelligence for the SD. That was the SS Intelligence Service. And Schoenberg was also on the board of directors of IT&T. And they were discussing, Hohenlohe and Dulles, they were discussing forming a separate peace, basically, between the Western powers and the Axis, if not during the war, then afterward. And Dulles was expressing what could only, I think, be fairly described as pro-Axis sentiments, referring to a speech by Joseph Goebbels as pure genius, and saying that no right-thinking person could possibly want the Jews to return to a position of power in Europe after the war, and saying that, oddly enough, that America was only keeping the war going to get, quote, get rid of the Jews, unquote. And then we jumped to 1963, which seemed like a long time to us, but it was only about 20 years after that meeting. And Lieutenant Colonel Ray Rocha, the Deputy Chief of Counterintelligence for the CIA, identified an unnamed Nazi who was named by Mr. De Pima and Carlos Bringer, both of them part of the anti-Castro Cuban milieu run by the CIA, an unnamed Nazi in Mexico City was identified by Rocha as none other than Prince Hohenlohe. And we then talked about Winfield Scott, who later appears as CIA station chief in Mexico City. And he was
if I may, David, a few points there. It should be noted that Rocha specifically identifies this man as a primary asset of the Mexico City station and someone who's directly involved in the murder of President Kennedy by inference, because that's why Sam DePino and Carlos Berenguer identify the man. They were sent into District Attorney of Orleans Parish, Jim Garrison's office, to infiltrate it and figure out who Garrison was trying to prosecute. And apparently, Berenguer and DePino came to the conclusion that this man, this Nazi intelligence agent in Mexico City, was directly involved in the murder of President Kennedy. So by inference, we should appreciate that's why Rocha identifies Max Egan von Holonoy in his internal memoranda. This is a direct reference to the murder of the president. And a correction on the name there. It's Winston Scott, not Winfield Scott. But please continue.
Oh, excuse me. I'm going to put the... You're absolutely right. Wasn't Winfield Scott, wasn't he a guy from one of the... one of the wars? Anyway, maybe Civil War or the War of 1812, something like that.
I believe so. But yeah, this is Winston McKinley Scott, CIA Station Chief, Mexico City in 1963.
But now, going back after World War II, in the immediate aftermath, we see Winston Scott networking with that very same Max Egan from Hohenlohe. And refresh my memory, Monty, Winston Scott was serving as sort of with the sort of pre-CIA, post-OSS CIA cutout.
Correct. It's a military intelligence group that was an interim unit between the Office of Strategic Services and Central Intelligence Agency called the SSU, or the Strategic Services Unit. And Win Scott had a ranking position in the counter-espionage branch of the SSU. He was the commander. He was a London station chief for counter-espionage for the entire SSU. And we now have documents out of the United Kingdom National Security Archive that identify him as the authenticating officer for all documents concerning Max Egan von Holonoy and his purchasing activities in Spain as an agent of Sofindis.
Oh, wow. So Max Egan, we're going to get to Sofindis. Again, this is one of the reasons why I consider myself, or it's an example of why I consider myself to be a student of your work. And maybe this will seem like gilding the lily, but one of the many sources of great satisfaction to me, Monty, I've been doing this for roughly half a century, the better part of half a century, and I began looking at Nazis and the JFK assassination courtesy of my late dear friend, Nate Russell, who passed away in 1988. Now it's 36 years later. And a new generation of researchers is moving up. You're one. Hal Sanderson is another with whom we'll be visiting. We visited with both of you on my Patreon channel. And by the way, on that Patreon platform, people can network directly with Monty or Hal Sanderson or others. But it is really, really satisfying to me to see a second generation coming up, and you exemplify and are sort of the gold standard for that second generation. So Winston Scott is networking directly with Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe in the immediate aftermath of World War II.
And as we shall see, a new document that's come to my attention just within the past 24 hours, we will be able to prove conclusively that Winston Scott was also the field commander in the Strategic Services Unit that was handling all documents pertaining to Johann Bernhardt, the founder of Sofindis. But please continue, Dave.
Right, we'll get to what Sofindis was, or perhaps is, in the although Sofindis may not exist. As the old, corrupting the old song said, the song is over, but the malady lingers on. Back to the subject of last week's program. Now, when Winston Scott is CIA station chief in Mexico City, he is networking not only with Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, the guy that Ray Rocha identified as probably the Nazi that Bettina and Berenguer were looking into or were referring to, but we looked at how Winston Scott is also networking with Von Hohenlohe and a group called Los Tecos. Los Tecos is a Mexican Nazi milieu. We looked at them at great length in AFA 15, recorded in March of 1986. They evolved from the Mexican gold trades, the Mexican fascist movement in the pre-World War II and World War II period. And in a series of columns by the late Jack Anderson, Los Tecos was identified as being one of the central elements in the coalition of Latin America death squads, networking in that regard with the CAL, the Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, the Latin American version of WACL. And we also took a look at how many researchers, and this is not to find fault with them, because we owe them a great deal, a great debt of gratitude for the work that they've done. But it now turns out that Z.R. Rifle was not, did not refer to marksmanship, but rather rifling files. It was a counterintelligence black bag job operation. And
correct, Dave. I should note, as we talked about in our previous program that we did together, just as a follow-up, ZR Rifle was a communications intercept program. It was a joint communications intercept program that specifically targeted foreign embassies for their diplomatic cables and codes. And the recruiting portion of it was called QJWIN. And that's where essentially some of the best second story men and safecrackers on the planet, most of them mafiosos and former fascist functionaries of the Third Reich, were hired into a joint NSA-CIA program. And I'd like to make very clear that when Richard Bissell, the former deputy director of plans for the CIA, gave his testimony to the Rockefeller Commission, specifically to David Belin and the Rockefeller Commission, he said that he was ordered by Alan Dulles directly to hide the CIA's assassination program within the communication intercept transmissions of ZR Rifle. So it was, in fact, a double entendre of sorts, Rifle being rifled through drawers to get documents, and then Rifle as a reference to his shoulder-mounted weapon, Rifle. So, you know, it was, just one of those gags that the CIA, one of those internal jokes that the CIA liked to play around with. But the reason why the executive action, you know, the assassination capability of the CIA was hidden inside of these communication intercepts is because this was the most sensitive, at the time, the most sensitive covert communications network established on the planet. So it would be incredibly difficult, nigh impossible, to intercept these messages and figure out exactly what they meant. You know, the best cryptographers on the planet were part of the ZR Rifle program. So that's the reason why Alan Dulles ordered Bissell to hide the assassination capabilities of the CIA within ZR Rifle. So it's actually a joint entity.
And so in effect, the researchers were more or less accurate in that ZR Rifle did obliquely and via misinformation or disinformation, it did refer to assassinations, but because the relevant facts were put into that in order to hide them.
Right.
Okay, wonderful. So it was sort of a...
Correct. And as we also stated in our previous program, just for a recap, the CIA portion of ZR Rifle is called Staff D. D for decryption was the code name prefix for that program. And the commander of Staff D for the entire Western Hemisphere was a woman by the name of Anne Goodpasture, who was personal deputy in 1963 to Winston Scott. So bear that in mind.
And you also referenced a wonderful piece of research by Bill Simbich, a brilliant researcher. Right. And in a chapter, I recall off the top of my head, was chapter 10 of that book. He basically detailed Anne Goodpasture and her alleged role in the machinations in Mexico City with regard to, quote, Lee Harvey Oswald, unquote, visiting the Cuban and or Soviet embassies. And the quotes referring to them. Yep. Go ahead.
That's a book called The 12 Who Built the Oswald Legend, Chapter 10, Nightmare in Mexico City. And it's an entire chapter dedicated to Anne Goodpaster and how she, her team, her counterintelligence team within Staff D was directly responsible for fabricating the fake phone calls into the Cuban and Soviet embassy that were purportedly conducted by Mr. Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy of the Dallas assassination plot against President Kennedy. And that was a program called L.I. Envoy. All capital letters spelling on that is L-I-E-N-V-O-Y. It was a massive, at the time, the most massive communications intercept program for wiretapping in the Western Hemisphere in 1963. And I should note that the functionality, this is really interesting, Dave, for your listening audience, the functionality of Staff D in Mexico City overlapped into anti-Castro Cuban affairs because the chief of covert action in 1963 for the anti-Castro effort was based out of the offices of Staff D and L.I. Envoy of Mexico City. And his name was David Atlee Phillips. Very interesting character. Working and, directly with Anne Goodpaster in this time period.
And he was, for quite some time, director of CIA for the Americas, basically, was he not?
Correct. From 19, I want to say roughly, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher this time period, but from about 1968 to about 1975, David Atlee Phillips was the chief of covert action for the entire Western Hemisphere division.
Very good. And so that, in a nutshell, with again, the tip of the hat to the many researchers who looked into ZR Rifle, big tip of the hat to the brilliant Bill Sibich for that work on Anne Goodpaster. What I want to do next, Monty, is to fill in some historical material that I think will perhaps clarify and fortify the listener's understanding of, you know, what we're talking about, Max Egan von Hohenlohe. He's a member of the Habsburg. He's in Europe, and then he's in Mexico, and he's working with Los Tecos. You know, what's up with that? On the SpitfireList.com website, and also on the 32 gigabyte flash drive, and by the way, I get no money whatsoever from that, there is a group, it's sort of a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy to download PDF files. And one of those books is the book Falange, The Secret Axis Army in the Americas by Alan Chase, published in 1943, by the way, the same year that Dulles was, networking with von Hohenlohe as an emissary for Schellenberg. And again, it might appear weird that we've got von Hohenlohe in Europe with Dulles and then in Mexico City with Los Tecos and Wayne Scott. But one of the many aspects of history that tends to escape Americans' notice is the fact that there are very strong aristocratic liaisons, plural, between the aristocracy of the old colonial powers, in this case Spain in particular, and the aristocracies in, and also the industrial and financial establishments in many of the countries that had formerly been Spanish-speaking colonies. That also goes for Portugal as well, with Brazil having been a Portuguese colony. Here in America, we don't have an aristocracy, but so people maybe wondering, what's that all about? But one of the things that Alan Chase talks about are the operational links between the Third Reich and Spain and Latin America. And one of the things he points out is that it was no accident that the very first substantive foreign action by the Nazis was to overthrow the government of Spain and to participate in the overthrow of the government of Spain and the military installation of Generalissimo Francisco Franco, courtesy of the Spanish Civil War. What I'm going to read about now is the excerpt on the SpitfireList.com website of Spain, its relationship to the New World. And this is a fundamental piece of background information with which to assess Max Egan von Hohenlohe, Wynne Scott, Los Picos, and so forth. Max Egan von Hohenlohe, as we looked at, had married into the Habsburg family in Spain. That's very, very important here. And he was a member of the Habsburg family. Here in California, Cinco de Mayo was a big holiday in the Latin American community, particularly the Mexican American community. It celebrates the Battle of Puebla in Mexico, in which the Mexican Republican with a small R forces defeated the armies of Prince Maximilian, ostensibly of France, but his full name was Maximilian von Habsburg. He had married into the French royal family, and he was there as an emissary at one level of France, but also this is part and parcel to the operational links that I'm about to discuss here. Reading from the description of Falange from 1943. In 1936, Reich Marshal Hermann Göring, one of Hitler's top aides and the head of the Luftwaffe, observed that, quote, Spain is the key to two continents, unquote. Göring was enunciating a key principle of German and Nazi geopolitics. By controlling Spain, the Nazis thought they could control both Europe and Latin America. Geographically dominating the entrance to the Mediterranean Sea from the Atlantic and, quote, flanking, unquote, France, Spain also wielded tremendous influence in Latin America through the strong cultural and economic ties between the Spanish and Latin American aristocracies. In addition, the profound Catholic influence in both Spain and Latin America augmented Spanish clout in that part of the world. In For the Record 532, we examined the Vatican's involvement with fascism. The Vatican fascist axis was another major contributing factor to the influence of the Falange throughout the Spanish-speaking world. By the way, Falange is spelled capital F-A-L-A-N-G-E. Continuing, in order to utilize Spain's geopolitical influence as a tool for Nazi imperial designs, the Third Reich turned to General Wilhelm von Vopel and his Ibero-American Institute. Von Vopel was a bitter opponent of the Weimar Republic and readily accepted the Nazis as the antidote to German democracy. Known as an IG general for his links to the IG Farben Company, von Vopel also maintained close ties to the powerful peace and interests which, like IG Farben, were the powers that backed Hitler. By the way, IG Farben also had, a profound, decisive dominance over the pharmaceutical market in Latin America. Continuing, in parentheses, the Bush family were also closely linked to the Pisans. During the 1920s, von Vopel had served as a general staff advisor to the Argentine, Brazilian, and Peruvian military establishments and was famed throughout Latin America for his skills as an officer. Because of his Latin American ties and his links to the corporate interests that backed Hitler, von Vopel became the Reich's point man for the fascist takeover of Spain and the subsequent construction of a fifth column throughout the Spanish-speaking world. In 1934, von Vopel assumed control of the Ibero-American Institute, an academic think tank originally founded as a legitimate scholarly institution. Under von Vopel, the organization became a front for organizing the Nazi infiltration and conquest of Spain. Rejecting royalist and Catholic sectarian rightist parties, von Vopel and the Nazis settled on the Falange as their chosen vehicle for gaining dominance over Spain. After arranging the assassination of General José Sanjurjo, that's capital S-A-N-J-U-R-J-O, a royalist rival for the leadership of Spain after the overthrow of the Republican government, the Germans and their Italian allies installed Franco as head of the fascist Falange than this discussion of the assassination of von Sirow, quoting from Falange. General Jose Sanjurjo, wearing a peacock's dream of a uniform, the London-made gift of Adolf Hitler, boarded a Junkers plane in Lisbon and ordered his pilot, Captain Ansaldo, A-N-S-A-L-B-O, to take off for a secret landing field in Spain. But on July 17th, the old general was actually headed for another landing field his Nazi comrades had chosen without his knowledge. A few remarks he had let slip to intimate friends in Estoril, E-S-T-O-R-I-L, earlier that year, had, unknown to Sanjurjo, reached certain Berlin ears. On April 13th, 1936, for instance, Sanjurjo had complained, quote, "They want me to start a revolution to serve the bankers and the speculators, but I won't do it," unquote. 2 weeks after saying this, he made another trip to Berlin. He remained in Germany for only a few days, and on his return, he went to work in earnest on his plans for the pending revolt. But what happened in Berlin while Sanjurjo conferred with von Vogel is a little moment now. His fate had already been sealed before the visit. Very shortly after Sanjurjo's plane took off from Lisbon, a German pine bomb planted in the baggage compartment exploded. The blazing fragments of the Junkers monoplane became the pyre of the anointed chief of the Spanish Revolution. Jose Sanjurjo had become the dubious honor of being the first of the Nazis' millions of victims of the Spanish War. And then, continuing, von Vogel then proceeded to direct the construction of a Falange Exterior as the fascist fifth column movement throughout the Spanish-speaking world, including the Philippines. And then more from Falange by Alan Chase. On the surface, von Vogel had, in the Falange Exterior, delivered to the Third Reich a remarkable network extending from Havana to Buenos Aires, from Lima to Manila. By the way, the headquarters, the epicenter of the Falange in the Americas was, drumroll fanfare, Havana, Cuba. And where do you suppose they went when Linda Castro took over? Continuing. This network, according to its creator, was capable of concerted espionage, political diversion, arms smuggling, and anything that any other fifth column in history had accomplished. It remained only for the Wehrmacht to give von Vogel's instrument the tests, which would determine whether the Auslands Falange had been worth all the trouble its organization had entailed. The answer was soon provided by a number of phalangists, among them one Jose del Castaño, C-A-S-T-A-N-O. Del Castaño was the primary Falange organizer in the Philippines. Recall that the Philippines had been a Spanish colony before the Spanish-American War. Del Castaño had organized the Falangists in the Philippines into a very effective fifth column, much of whose membership had been listed in the Philippine Civilian Emergency Administration, charged with dispensing first aid and other emergency services in times of war. During the Japanese attack in 1941, Del Castaño's agents went to work. Chase describes what happened on pages 46 and 47, and quoting directly. Toward the end of November, Jose del Castaño made a thorough checkup on the work of the Falange Exterior in the Philippines. He sent a coded report to Madrid via preparations taken by his Falanges. On December 7th, Spain's Japanese Axis partner bombed Hawaii and the Philippines. In Manila, after the shock of the first attack, the people looked to the government, to the army, to the Civilian Emergency Administration for guidance. In most cases, the average Filipino turned to the CEA, or under ordinary circumstances, the proper thing to do. But on September 7, 1941, the CEA was so shot through with Falangistas, as to be the foundation of the Axis Fifth Column in that city. On December 29, the Japanese Air Forces staged their first great raid over the city of Manila. For 3 hours, the Jap planes rained bombs on the forts along the bay, the docks, and the homes of the poor Filipinos. Then the planes flew off. But something had happened during the bombardment. the civilian defense organizations seem to have broken down completely. Warriors were receiving orders to be everywhere except the places where they were needed most. Stretcher bearers were dropping like flies with bullets in their backs. Streams of confusing and conflicting orders had most CEA workers running around in crazy circles, unquote. And then I add, on page 47, Trace also notes that the Falangistas spread wild rumors to undermine the will to resist the Japanese invaders, rumors that were all the more potent because they originated with personnel during the within the emergency administration. Quote, wild rumors spread like hurricanes through the city, rumors the character of which had already become familiar in all lands invaded by the Nazis in Europe. MacArthur had fled to Washington. Quezon had gone over to the Japs. He was the president of the Philippines. The entire American Air Force had been destroyed. The American Army had received orders to shoot all Catholics and imprison all Filipinos. Henry Morgenthau had personally requisitioned all the funds in the Philippine National Treasury. Ad infinitum. There was something official about these rumors. Something had been added that made even level-headed citizens give them credence. For these rumors were not being spread by obscure Japanese spies. They originated directly from the civilian emergency headquarters, from the lips of the hard-working air raid wardens who had been so diligent about packing up the posters bearing the pen emergency pointers for the citizens. Get your facts straight from the CEA, unquote. And then I add, I conclude, for the contemporary reader, it is vital to remember that Latin America and the Philippines will never be Falangized. Franco and his fascists remained in power in Spain until 1975. Portugal remained under the control of the fascist dictator Salazar for decades after the war. The decisive influence of Latin American fascists in the decades following the war, including their intimate collaboration with elements of U.S. intelligence, is a matter of public record. The legacy of the Falange Exterior is very much with us today. And with that characteristically wordy introduction, Monty, again, that, I'm presenting that as background information to not only what you presented to us last week, the continuum from Max Egan von Hohenlohe, Spanish in-law of the Habsburgs, networking with Alan Dulles on behalf of Walter Schellenberg, on up to Winston Scott in the immediate post-World War II period, networking directly and heavily with the aforementioned Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, and then to the assassination of JFK and Lieutenant Colonel Ray Rocha, James Jesus Angleton's deputy for counterintelligence for the CIA and the in-house expert on the JFK, for the agency, for the CIA, for the JFK assassination. He opines that the Nazi that Garrison was apparently looking for may very well have been none other than Max Egan von Hohenlohe. Then we looked at, and then, so Winston Scott then hooking up with Los Picos, the Mexican Nazi organization. All of this may appear weird to the uninitiated, but actually it makes a great deal of institutional and historical sense. So forgive me for waxing so wordy there, Monty, but I think that what you're about to present to us and what you're going to be developing further on the foundation of what you presented last week will make a lot more sense to members of the audience. Again, just think about the Cinco de Mayo holiday. It celebrates the Battle of Puebla when French Emperor Maximilian von Habsburg, again, part of the same family as Max Egan von Hohenlohe, was overthrown as the Emperor of Mexico. So, Monty, Spain, bearing in mind the Falange's capital was in Havana, Cuba, and three guesses where they went when Castro took over, proceed for us.
On that note, I'd like to backpedal to the Hohenlohe aristocracy and the if I may real quick before jumping into Falange and Sofindis, I'd like to backpedal to the Hohenlohe aristocracy and other members of the, I suppose the only way to word this is the extended family of, oh, for Pete's sake, Queen Victoria, Queen Victoria herself.
Yes.
And just, who were the functionaries of the Third Reich that were members of Queen Victoria's extended family and in turn the Holonoi aristocracy, if I may, David?
Yes, and by the way, one of the things that we need to bear in mind as we talk about this is the extent to which the aristocracies and the royal houses of Europe were heavily intermarried. Kaiser Wilhelm II, for example, was Queen Victoria's grandson. And Tsar Nicholas II of Russia was his cousin. In the run-up to World War I, they were exchanging letters, you know, dear Nicky, dear Willie, and so forth. And then their respective armies were slaughtering each other by the millions on the barbed wire with the howitzers and machine guns. So,
on that note, I'd like to quote directly from an article published by the London Review of Books. It's written by Richard J. Evans, who is the Regius Professor Emeritus of History at Cambridge University and the former president of Wolfson College. And he published a 3-volume history on the Third Reich called The Pursuit of Power, Europe, 1815 to 1914. And the article that I'm reading from is from volume 38, number six, and it's published 17 March 2016 in the London Book Reviews by Professor Richard J. Evans. And it's a book review of a book called The Go-Betweens for Hitler by Karina Urbach. And that last name is spelled Urbach. And that's published by Oxford Press in July of 2015. Once again, that book is called The Go-Betweeners for Hitler, by Karina Urbach, last name Urbach, Karina Urbach, and reading from the article, quote, whenever their faith, the monarchs of Europe were bound to each other by a vast network of family interconnections presided over by Queen Victoria, whose longevity made her Europe's matriarch for much of the 19th century. Her grandchildren, including Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, the queens of Greece, Norway, Romania, Spain, and Sweden, the Grand Duke Louis IV of Hesse, of the House of Hesse, the Grand Duchess Victoria and Elizabeth, and the Tsarian Alexandria of Russia, Prince Alfred Saxon Kohlberg Gotha, Princess Alexandra Holonoi Langenberg, Princess Patrice Orleans de Bourbon, the Duchess of Galleria, Prince Albert Duke Schwentig-Holstein, Princess Marie-Louise Anhalt, and Princess Alice of Trek. During the First World War, it was a challenge to this high society of monarchs and aristocrats. The Russian-born Dagrid Duchess of Colburn was denounced in Germany as a spy. She was British before she became German, having married Queen Victoria's second son, Alfred, before he became the Duke of Coburg. The British-born Duchess Daisy Place wrote that she, quote, had relatives and dear friends in England, Germany, Austria, Hungary, France, Spain, Russia, and Sweden. How well these best elements of the fighting nations knew each other and others, despite this having to continue killing each other, end quote. She was obliged to declare her allegiance to Germany, but her husband's country. Aristocratic men could join the army of their choice, but many of the great families fell to suspicion because of their connections to the enemy side, meaning the Axis powers or the Tri-Party. The British royal family had to change its name to Wisner in 1917, and the titles the Titles Deprivation Act, which was passed that very same year in 1917, which stripped the British titles from the German nobility. That included Carl Edward of Sachsen-Coburg-Gotha, who lost his dukedom in Albany. At the start of the war, he had publicly renounced his position as a Seaford Highlanders and re- And in return, he was removed from the line of succession of his dukedom from all British, Belgium, and Portuguese relatives. So, real quick, Dave, what we have here is the extended family members of Queen Victoria all fighting each other during the First World War. And immediately after the First World War, the elements that found themselves within the enemy camp, as it were stripped of their titles. This included the British, Belgium, and Portuguese titles. But continuing with this article, being forced to take sides didn't mean that members of the high aristocracy necessarily abandoned their cross-border family ties. On the contrary, they used them in a variety of ways to act as go-betweens for national governments. With their international networks, mastery of intrigue, and command of numerous languages, they were useful in suing peace when European governments wanted to avoid official channels. Since the majority of diplomats belonged to aristocratic families, 70% of the 550 men who served in the German Foreign Office were titled, it felt natural to use their dynastic links and their dealings with other countries. I should read that again, David. 70% of the 550 personnel that served in the German Foreign Office during the Second World War had dynastic links to Queen Victoria. Practically the entirety of the German foreign staff of the Third Reich were extended family members of Queen Victoria. Continuing. Empress Zita Bourbon Parma, the wife of the young Karl I of Austria and the Fourth of Hungary, became the Emperor of Austria in 1916 after the death of Franz Josef, made strenuous efforts to broker peace between Austria and the Entente powers via Princess Sarissa, a member of the Habsburg network, conveniently domiciled in neutral Switzerland. Austria, Zita was reported to have said, did not desire a ruin for the sake of saving Alice Lorraine of Germany. The Germans got wind of the intrigue and bullied the Austrian emperor into disavowing it. As a result, the German grip on the Habsburg monarchy was tightened and the emperor discredited in the eyes of the Czech, Hungarian, and other nationalists who now saw him as little more than a tool of Hindenburg and Ludendorff, the German military leaders.
And this political / aristocratic axis, and I think that's a useful term, predates World War II, and the negotiations that we've looked at, we'll get right back to in a second, Marty, those could be seen, I think, as an extension of the same dynamic / relationship.
Absolutely. Continuing with the article. The consequences of aristocratic plotting were even more far-reaching in Romania, where the Central Powers conducted, despite intrigues, in order to get the King Ferdinand, a member of the Hohenzollern-Sigmaringen family, and therefore German by origin and connection, to commit the country to the side after he ascended the throne in October 1914. His strong-willed wife, Marie, had been born and partly brought up in England by her parents. The then Duke of Edinburgh and his wife, kept up her connections with King George V, who had once asked her to marry him and the Russian royal family, and Romania joined the Entente in August of 1916. Both the general public and the Romanian political class were overwhelmingly in favor of the decision, which was underpinned by the promise of territorial gains for Hungary. So it would be an exaggeration to say that Princess Marie played the most important role in bringing it about, but her contacts certainly helped. By the end of the war, the world of the European high aristocracy had collapsed. The Tsar had been overthrown in a revolution, and the Bolsheviks quickly disposed of the leading noble members, many of whom members were killed or forced to flee. In Central Europe, the Habsburg monarchy was replaced by a collection of nation-states ruled by the bourgeois politicians. In Germany, the reigning princely houses disposed and their properties were seized, a protracted series of lawsuits over the issue of compensation followed. The 1920s were not a good time for German aristocrats. Many were forced to eke out a living in jobs they considered beneath them. They blamed democracy and the Weimar Republic for destroying the habits of deference that had sustained them before the First World War. Nazism.
By the way, Martin, something I want to remind listeners of very quickly. In the immediate aftermath of World War One, the Hotspurs went to work for or with U.S. better way of putting it, with U.S. intelligence. This from the book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch and discussed in For the Record 1009. So remember that as we listen to the evolution of this, and here's my favorite word, milieu, that it has a direct relationship with U.S. intelligence by the immediate post-World War One period. Go ahead, Marty.
Thank you. And the 19, continuing, they blamed democracy for destroying the habits of deference that had sustained them during the war. Nazism was attractive because it promised revenge on the Bolsheviks and the socialists who had toppled them, and its cult of leadership struck a chord. When Hitler came to power in 1933, they were given a chance to play a role again. Erich von dem Bock-Zelewski had been forced to run a taxi firm in the Weimar Republic. Under the Third Reich, Erich dem Bock-Zelewski became commander of the brutal suppression of the Warsaw Uprising and oversaw the Bandekamp units, or the bandit fighter units on the Eastern Front that were essentially all of the Einsatzgruppen that oversaw the occupation of Riga and Minsk and Belarusa. So a member, so it should be noted that this Bock-Zelewski that is mentioned as a member of the extended imperial royal family oversaw the mass murder of 100,000 men, women, and children in Riga and Minsk during the Second World War.
And then the Einsatzgruppen leaders, then went to work by and large for, the Office of Policy Coordination, then CIA and so forth. And they evolved directly on up to the events of 11/22/63. Go ahead, Bobby.
Right. So, spelling on that last name is, B-A-C-H hyphen capital Z-E-L-E-W-S-K-I. And Bock-Zelewski, what was just to note again, the commander of all the Einsatzgruppen in occupied Belarusa, and the commander of the bandit fighting units, an extended family member of Queen Victoria. Continuing, Ludolf von Alvensleben, last name spelled A-L-V-E-N. S-L-E-B-E-N, ran a car firm, which he had set up after losing his Polish estate and went bankrupt. During the Second World War, Ludolf von Alvensleben was the leader of the SS and all police and Gestapo units in occupied Poland and the Soviet Union. It should be noted that his father, during the First World War, was a Prussian Major General, Ludolf von Alvensleben, same name, who was once again an extended family member of Queen Victoria. He would be essentially a great nephew of Queen Victoria. Commander of all SS units and police and Gestapo units in occupied Poland and the Soviet Union. Continuing with the article. Karl von Eberstedt worked in the 1920s as a travel agent. However, under the Third Reich, as a member once again of German Mobility and the House of Halle and Stahles, once again an extended family member of Queen Victoria, Karl von Eberstedt was an early member of the Nazi Party, the SA, and the SS, and personal attaché between Reinhard Heydrich and Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS and the head of the Reich's main security command, a great nephew of Queen Victoria. Continuing. All three of these officers became senior members of the SS, an organization whose head, Heinrich Himmler, believed that the aristocracy represented superior blood. By 1938, nearly one-fifth of all senior-ranking members of the SS were filled by holders of noble titles. The former German royal family was enthusiastically brought on board. Prince August Wilhelm of Prussia, Awi, joined the stormtroopers well before 1933, and Crown Prince Friedrich Wilhelm was an outspoken supporter of Hitler in the presidential election of 1932, and the Grand Duke of Mecklenburg and the Prince of Waldeck and Primorje, both extended family members of Queen Victoria, were members of the SS even before the Nazis seized power. There were many others like them. Two of the most prominent were Princes Philip and Christoph of Hesse, both great-grandsons of Queen Victoria. Prince Philip became the King of Italy's son-in-law, and Christoph rose to the rank of Major General in the SS. In his engrossing account of their roles as mediators between Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy, the book Royals in the Reich, the American historian Jonathan Petropoulos showed how their ability to smooth things over became critical and crucial junctures. Carl Edward Saxon Kohlberg Gotha, another of Queen Victoria's grandchildren, so resented the Weimar Republic that he funded and supported Organization Consul, a terrorist group that murdered 300 leading Republican politicians of the Weimar Republic. Kohlberg became a hotbed of Nazism, and the party's electoral process before 1933 endeared the Duke to its leaders. Its international networks made him an obvious candidate as a go-between for Hitler. Like the Princess of Hesse, he was also an admirer of Mussolini, who retained the Italian monarchy, given members of the Italian nobility a leading place in his regime. The Duke of Kohlberg's value to Hitler lay above all in his close contacts with the British royal family, many of whom he had known from his English childhood. Under the Third Reich, his presence became acceptable in England again, as Hitler, widely regarded as having restored social and political order in Germany. He was invited in January 1932 and again in January of 1933 to Stangenram to meet George V and Queen Mary, and visited England on numerous other occasions. When the king died in 1936, Carl Edward turned up to his funeral and joined the procession dressed in the uniform of the general of a Wehrmacht, complete with a steel helmet, a tiny incongruous figure amid all the tall ostrich-plume guardsmen and courtiers. He forged close relationships with the Prince of Wales, his cousin, who was sympathetic to his plea of an Anglo-German alliance. "Has the House of Wisner forgotten its German roots?" Kohlberg asked him pointedly. The prince, soon to be Edward VIII, and already under the influence of his mother, Queen Mary, who maintained regular contacts with German relations, reciprocated by urging his former comrades in the British Legion to visit Germany and offer the hand of friendship to the Nazi regime. A Spanish diplomat reported in 1940 that Edward, upset about the war, throws all the blame on the Jews and the Reds in Eden and his people in the Foreign Office and other Jewish politicians, all of whom he would like to have put up against the wall and shot. He also expressed similar views, the Spaniard added, before he became Edward VIII. Erzbach assembles plenty evidence to demonstrate that Edward's pro-Nazi views and his advocacy of a German-Anglo alliance. Nobody should be surprised that he taught his young nieces, Princess Elizabeth, the future queen, and Princess Margaret, the Nazi salute, not as a satirical gesture, but as a trivializing piece of play. Every morning, Princess Margaret and Princess Elizabeth would greet their father with the Nazi salute. More surprisingly is the evidence that Erbach...
By the way, Princess Elizabeth later became known as Queen Elizabeth, and when she passed away recently, there was much fanfare and, celebration, but that's who we're talking about here. That when she's a little girl, she's greeting Daddy in the morning. Sieg Heil! Go ahead.
Yes, every morning she would greet her father with Heil Hitler, Father. Continuing. More surprisingly is the evidence that Erbach presents in his brother, who became King George VI after Edward was forced to abdicate in 1936. He had great sympathies, King George VI, as a report sent to the German Foreign Offices noted that year, for the Third Reich. The Duke of Kohlberg continued to visit the British royal family even after he received the former king, now the Duke of Wisner, on his visit to Nazi Germany in 1937. During his visit, the Duke rendered the Nazi salute with a practiced and enthusiastic arm and was lionized by the grandees of the Third Reich. Kohlberg also headed up the German-English Society in Germany, purging it of its non-Nazi members and Jewish members, and was closely involved in its counterpart in London, the Anglo-German Fellowship, overseen by the president of J. Henry Schroeder Bank, Frank Tarkas. He had several conversations with King George VI during the Munich crisis and may have well persuaded him to back the deal that forced Czechoslovakia to let itself be dismembered by the Nazis. The king.
One second, Andy. We are almost out of time here. I'm going to wrap this show up and then we'll begin our next program. So, hold, but not only that thought, but that place will pick right up where we left off here. We have been speaking with Monty, my new co-host, and I guess one could refer to this program now as Formal Record 2.0, the Monty and Emery Show. We are talking about some of the historical foundation for the Max Egan von Hohenlohe Alan Dulles Schellenberg Nexus and the Max Egan von Hohenlohe Wynne Scott Nexus and the events of 11-22-63, Jim Garrison's investigation, Lieutenant Colonel Ray Roca's estimate of that, and we should never lose sight of Ray Roca's observation that Jim Garrison would get a conviction of Clay Shaw, barring interference, which he helped to do, that vindicating not only Jim Garrison, but authors like Jim DiGenio and many others who have very courageously carried the Garrison banner forward. Two links at the top of each written for the record description and each food for thought post that will enable you to subscribe to the podcasts that were made by Sister Station WFMU, and also to get the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my life's work, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books, including Falange from 1943, the parts of which I read earlier in the program. This concludes For the Record program number 1329, conversation number 3 with Monty. This is being recorded on June 8th. Of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.